Hello, this is the Conversations Politics podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. The second volume of the official history of ASIO has just been released. It covers the years from 1963 to 1975, which includes the dramatic Whitlam government period that saw Attorney General Lionel Murphy launch his infamous so-called raid on ASIO headquarters in Melbourne. The second volume has been written by John Blaxland, who is a senior fellow at the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the Australian National University and an expert on intelligence and security matters. He joins us today. John Blaxland, you and others in the Official History Project have had extraordinary access to ASIO's files. Tell us something about the project itself. Were there any constraints on the writing? And was, for example, the manuscript vetted?
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. Professor David Horner, who was the series editor for this three-volume history of ASIO, when he agreed to conduct this history, the history had to be written at the ANU. It was not going to be written at ASIO's buildings. And it was very important for us to be able to have some distance so we weren't going to be in a position of being accused of being subject to the Stockholm syndrome or something like that. It was very important for us as objective historians, as far as you can be that, to have some distance and to be able to look at the files and the material in a dispassionate manner without feeling any pressure from the organisation to write it in a way that would suit them. And that's certainly the approach that David took with Volume 1, and he very much encouraged me to take that approach with Volume 2 as well. So in doing so, I've had Dr. Rhys Crawley, an outstanding historian and author of the chapter on Papua New Guinea, help. He conducted a lot of the research and some of the interviews as well. Together, the three of us really worked on this project. I wrote it, but David had significant editorship in terms of providing me some guidance and counsel about pulling this together and being as objective as possible, particularly over some of the more contentious matters that the book addresses.
And how did you cope with the files? Did you physically bring them across?
We photocopied extracts of the files, thousands and thousands of files that we looked at and drew extracts from, and then put them in front of my screen with the laptop and work through drawerfuls of cabinetfuls of file extracts that we used to write chapter after chapter. So we organised. I basically read as much as I could beforehand, and then structured my thoughts about how the book would be written, and then we then collected the material from ASIO in the subject headings matching the paragraph, the chapter structure that I had set up, and then drew that out of ASIO, and then went through chapter by chapter drafting the material, pulling
and
it
was
together.
There any vetting?
Oh yes, it was definitely vetting. And the thing about the vetting, it's very interesting, the process that we went through. We learned from the British experience of the MI5 and MI6 histories, and we realised that we needed to adopt a slightly different approach. We really remained in control all the way through, but one of the things we agreed to was that we would concede on matters of operational sensitivity or where there were legal obligations from ASIO to maintain secrecy, particularly over things like agents' names, areas where there was a legal obligation and appropriate level of restraint exercised in what was communicated. So, for instance, the name of an agent, while there were some that I really wanted to put in the book, I conceded that that was probably not the best thing because of ASIO's policy. They have a policy about not mentioning ASIO's agents' names. And so I agreed in that we wouldn't put them in, but we'd sometimes use a pseudonym or just describe the position that the person was occupying. So it's like pixelating the news. You know, you get a number plate of a car at a crime scene might be pixelated out, or the face of an individual who might be involved in the incident. So the story is real. Some of the details have been pixelated. And we've done that as little as possible to keep the vitality and the kind of integrity of the story and the detail of the story together, so that the reader can get a real sense of the tension and the drama of the story.
Now, I think the law prohibits the naming of ASIO people below the first couple right at the top of the tree. Are you covered by that law, for example, people who were agents but are no longer, or does the earlier situation apply to them?
There are agents and then there are ASIO officers. ASIO officers are employees of the government directly, and some of them have been named where they have signed a waiver, where they have agreed to have their name mentioned in the book, and where the organisation was satisfied that there were no operational implications by releasing their name. So there are quite a number of names that are released for the first time in this book of ASIO officers who were involved in some pretty hair-raising events, and they've agreed to have their names mentioned, and others that the organisation felt really was best not to include, and others actually who didn't want to. So some of them, there's a couple of the stories in there, the really great stories, but we had to cover up the details because the person involved really didn't want to be mentioned. So we said we had to respect that.
Just one other question on the mechanics of producing this book. What sort of attitude did you find from people in ASIO when you were going in and going through files and that sort of thing?
Look, at the top levels, great support, excellent support from a succession of directors general and deputies who worked for them. There were some people in some corners who were, you know, understandably reticent about the level of detail we were going to reveal in this volume. This is really, in many ways, uncharted territory, and a lot of people were quite uncomfortable, understandably so, about just how much of the way ASIO has done its business was being revealed. And the other thing is that this is a warts and all story. This is, I haven't really pulled my punches here in terms of describing ASIO's pitfalls as well as some of its achievements. So that for some people, that's left them quite uncomfortable. But thankfully, with the right people in the organisation who I was working with, understood, had the vision for the purpose of this book and explaining the importance of having this story, this significant story on Australian history, out there so that people who, you know, could for many years have wondered about this organisation could have some clarity about what it was doing during this incredibly contentious period in Australian history.
One theme that comes through is that during this period, ASIO was still somewhat stuck in the past, that it was preoccupied with the communist threat to the exclusion of other emerging things, for example, Croatian terrorism, and so on. Is that a fair description?
It's a perhaps slightly oversimplified. There is what was happening in ASIO in the early to mid-1960s was a slow realisation that the Communist Party of Australia was withering and its potency as a potentially revolutionary body was fading. But that was happening while the Vietnam War protest movement was gathering steam. And so it was actually very hard for a lot of people to separate the two in their minds. And as the Communist Party of Australia stops getting Soviet funding in 1967, the anti-Vietnam War protest movement is completely ramping up. Prague Spring happens in 1968, and it tears the soul out of the Communist Party of Australia, essentially. And so you have a really significantly demoralised body of people who were the prime focus of ASIO, and yet the anti-war protest movement's gathering so much steam. Surely the Communist Party's behind all of this. And it was very hard for a lot of people to actually realise that what was happening wasn't so much fermenting revolution as legitimate dissent. And of course, there were other fractions, you know, the groups that splintered off from the Communist Party, the Trotskyites, the Communist Party of Australia, Marxist-Leninist, the Socialist Party of Australia, who still believed, you know, had the fervour for the revolution. But this is a small group of people. This is, you know, people with intent but no capability. or very little capability, and yet there was, you know, it was hard for ASIO, with its old Cold War mindset, having been so successful at doing this in the 1950s, to deal with the baby boomer generation, which was really changing the equation on so many fronts in Australian society. ASIO was symptomatic of institutional catch-up taking place.
And it had all those agents in place in the Communist Party, so exactly. It would be reluctant to reassign and waste all those resources.
Well, you know, it had hundreds of agents in the Communist Party. In fact, arguably, it was helping propping up the Communist Party. People in, you know, important secretary positions and treasurer appointments, you know, who were great conduits of information to ASIO about how those particular branches were stacking up. But, of course, had they not been there, perhaps the CPA wouldn't have been as robust in the first place. It was a bit of a catch-22.
One of the things that rather surprised me reading the book was thinking about the present context of terrorist threats and so on, how many actual threats there were. They might have been small scale, but there were bombs thrown and all sorts of incidents. Can you tell us a little about those?
No, you're absolutely right. It's actually a very important part of the story, and it's easily forgotten. And, you know, when we do a broad sweep of the 60s and early 70s, most people don't think about bombings and terrorism as part of the equation. But this story makes it very clear that ASIO did see it. They saw it, and it wasn't necessarily resourced appropriately to the right level, but particularly in terms of Croatian extremism and the interesting interplay with the Yugoslav Intelligence Service. And actually being able to figure out who was behind some of these terrorist incidents, these bombings, these relatively small bombs per se in an individual case. But when you aggregated it, it was really quite scary what was going on. And it was actually hard for ASIO to discern between the work of Croatian subversion or Croatian terrorism and the hand of the Yugoslav Intelligence Service. Very, very cleverly playing the Croatians to goad them into overplaying their hand against the government, and therefore justifying the Yugoslav pressure on the Australian government to crack down on right-wing groups. So it was a bit of a conundrum, because there was right-wing extremism. The Yugoslavs saw that, but they played it up as well. And then we had a series of successions of attorneys general, who some of whom were prepared to place some emphasis on this, and others who thought, hey, leave the Croatians alone. Of course, this is then what Lionel Murphy latched onto when he became attorney general in 1973. He saw the Croatians as being in bed with ASIO. He saw ASIO as playing a game of subterfuge, covering up for Croatian extremism. And he was fed this line by a former police officer who had a chip on his shoulder about ASIO's approach anyway. So he wasn't getting dispassionate advice. And then, of course, you know, in that classic moment of kind of almost Les Patterson-like, you know, conducts the raid of ASIO and doesn't find what he thought he was going to find, because it's just not there. It was quite a moment, in some respects, an embarrassing moment for Australia, but in terms of the organisation, this was almost a mortal blow. The organisation really, many people went into depression during this period. People felt really, really just betrayed, maybe really shocked that the government would take this step. And of course, the ramifications internationally were profound as well.
Just tell us a little bit more about that night when Murphy decided to move, and then the next morning when he flew to Melbourne and there was this raid and a lockdown by the Commonwealth Police and high scenes of drama. Just unpack that a bit for us.
Well, when Gough Whitlam became Prime Minister, he invited the Yugoslav Prime Minister to come to Australia, and in looking at the security assessments that were required for protecting the Yugoslav Prime Minister, it became apparent that there were Croatian elements who were keen to pose a threat to his life. So there were threats of assassination. This spooked Murphy. The notice of this came through the police, not through ASIO. So it was actually an ASIO. It was a police informant who provided this bit of information. And ASIO wasn't actually privy to that bit of information. But Murphy was convinced that ASIO must be hiding some details. So he went to the ASIO office here in Canberra.
Late at night,
early in the morning, and demanded to have access to the files himself. Never before had an Attorney General asked for direct access to the files. So that in itself was unprecedented. A sign of deep distrust for his own organisation. He then, having read what he saw on the files in Canberra, wasn't satisfied that this was the end of the story, demanded to then go to Melbourne the next morning, and where ASIO headquarters was then located, and look at the files there. And in doing so, he ordered the Federal Police, or Commonwealth Police it was then, to close the doors, lock the safes, and make sure that nobody got in or out. And this had a really demoralising effect on the organisation. He was then escorted in. The Director General, Peter Barber at the time, showed him in, gave him access to all the material he sought to have access to. Realising that there was nothing particularly consequential there, he then left and went back to Canberra and left Barber to pick up the pieces. And of course, it was going to be quite some time before ASIO was able to pick up the pieces.
Now, in opposition, you're speaking about when Labor had just come into government, but in opposition during the 60s, do you think that Labor criticisms of ASIO were justified?
A lot of them were, yes. ASIO was, but it wasn't just ASIO's fault. This was partly the Labor Party's fault and partly the Conservative government's fault, because it was a build-up, compound of factors, going back to the reaction of the Labor Party to the defection of the Petrovs in the mid-1950s, where the Labor Party, particularly Doc Evatt, the leader then of the party, saw this as a conspiracy, saw this as very much Menzies' orchestrated attempt to undermine the Labor Party and to split the Labor Party. Of course, it wasn't that. It was, and David Horner completely, very systematically debunks the theories about what happened with Petrov in Volume 1. But the Labor Party of the early 1970s still was not completely convinced. In fact, Gough Whitlam's son, Nick Whitlam, wrote a book, Nest of Traitors, and Gough actually launched it. So there was still this real sense of, no, you can't trust ASIO, they're working for the other side. And of course, that wasn't helped by the fact that after Evatt, there was a real reluctance of the then Conservative government to let ASIO engage the opposition, the Labor opposition. So it had a compounding effect. And by the time Murphy's the Attorney General, ASIO is just seen as completely beholden to the Liberal Country Party coalition, which, that was understandable to a point that they thought that, but in hindsight, it was really quite unreasonable.
Now, the Americans were very clearly disturbed about the whole situation with intelligence swapping during those Labor years. What do the files tell you about American concern?
Well, this was really a period of unprecedented challenge to the established order. And the Americans had been used to the Australian government being very supportive and compliant with the requests of the United States. Pine Gap had been established really without much questioning. The arrangements were all very much, seen as Australia following consistently US requests. And then, of course, all of a sudden, the Whitlam government comes along and takes quite a different view. And this, many people in Washington find this quite disconcerting. First of all, the Whitlam government doesn't want its senior officials to be security vetted. Well, this really puts the cat amongst the pigeons, because of course they've all got access to some of the most sensitive documents coming out from the intelligence community. Most people would realise and appreciate that to have access to that, you really do need to be vetted for your background as to whether or not you are going to be trustworthy with that information. That's now an established practice. Back in 1973, that wasn't such an established practice. And so that set the tone. Whitlam and Murphy subsequently backed down on that and agreed that they would have their personnel vetted. But there were a series of issues that developed. In 1974, Dr. Jim Cairns is appointed as Deputy Prime Minister. This is a man who, in the in the late 60s and early 70s had been leading the anti-Vietnam War protest movement, closely associated with members of the Communist Party, seen as being quite anti-American, and the thought of him having access to secret American-sourced intelligence really was for some people quite a hair-raising thought. So there were, you know, Barber, the attorney, the director general, had to assure the Americans that wasn't going to happen, and he sought assurances from Whitlam as well. And it's interesting how Whitlam played it, because Whitlam saw Murphy, there's quite an adversarial relationship going on there as well between Whitlam and Murphy as well, and Whitlam doesn't trust Murphy that much either. But that then is compounded as time goes on, and as we get closer to the Remembrance Day 40 years ago, the 11th of November 1975, things come to a bit of a climax.
Just before we move on right to the end of that, Barber, of course, was caught in the middle of a lot of these pressures, and in the end, towards the end of the Whitlam government, resigned quite suddenly. What was the story behind that?
Yeah, he resigned under pressure.
And how do you assess his general performance?
Look, Peter Barber is a World War II veteran. He was Spry's appointed successor when Spry retired in early 1970. He was seen as bookish, intelligent, well-read, and an ideas man to a point. But he lacked some of the managerial competence. He lacked, you know, you need to be a senior manager of a challenging part of the bureaucracy. You need to have some courage. You need to be decisive. You need to be able to lead and drive an organization. He had ideas, but many people really felt he wasn't the right man at the right time to grasp some difficult nettles and push for reform. It was a very difficult time too, let's not forget. He was under enormous pressure. The government was already pushing for reform. Justice Robert Marsden Hope was appointed in mid-1974 to conduct a Royal Commission on Intelligence and Security. So, and that he wouldn't report until 1977 under Malcolm Fraser when he was Prime Minister. So Barber's under a lot of pressure to reform, to bring about some change, but also to let the process of the Royal Commission take its course and be supportive of the Royal Commission. Extraordinary pressures, and a government that is still, you know, not warming to ASIO very much, although recognising, and Murphy and Whitlam both recognise, that organisationally ASIO needs to exist, although they don't quite like what it was up to. So Barber was, a man who he had done some good things early on in his time as the Director General, but by mid-1975, he was past his prime and he needed to move on, and Whitlam saw that and it basically showed him the door.
Now, there have always been some conspiracy theories around the dismissal of the Whitlam government. Mm. Not majority theories, but some people have persisted in them. Did your research provide enough evidence to definitively rule out such theories?
You know, that's a difficult question to answer, simply because in this period, and this is before the Archives Act, many files were destroyed. There was a sense, there was an understanding, and this was something that the Whitlam government supported at the time, that certain ASIO files should not be kept. They should actually be destroyed. So records were culled when, in hindsight, we probably would like to have had them kept.
So what was the reason for destroying them?
Well, there was this sense that privacy was being not respected, and that that ASIO had been too intrusive earlier on, and that those records of intrusion shouldn't be kept. And so the organisation was really encouraged to cull. And, you know, now we think about it today with the Archives Act and our approach to retention of data and of records, that's just anathema. You wouldn't do that. But back then you did. So having said that, we have scanned, we have gone through the ASIO records as they stand in detail. And what we have in the final chapter of Volume 2 is as authoritative an account as possible from the records of what ASIO knew and what ASIO did in relation to the dismissal in November 1975. That story is not as bleak as some people would like to think.
No conspiracy.
There is a kernel of truth on which I think the conspiracy theories have hung. And that is that the CIA was deeply disturbed at what was happening. Ted Shackley calls in the senior liaison officer in Washington and effectively offers, dictates to him a message, which he then relays back, and it's relayed to the ambassador, it's relayed back to the Australian Prime Minister. Now, there are some who would say, oh, you know, Shackley didn't want him to do that. But the notion that that the senior liaison officer wasn't going to pass that message to the government is just, you know, it's just nonsensical. So that message was passed, and it was what on earth is going on here? Please, and it was to the Director General of Asia to please do something. And of course, he passed that message on. Director General Frank Marnie passed it on to Gough Whitlam, and Whitlam read it and, you know, quite nonchalantly dictated an answer, which was, look, there's nothing to be concerned about here. You know, we understand your concerns, but don't worry about it. There are those who would say that this was a deep conspiracy in and of itself. And yet, really, when you think about it, what else was the United States to do? It was heavily invested in Australia. It was worried about what was going on. If they had not sought to engage Australia on what it saw as deeply concerning developments, revelations about CIA employees. By Whitlam, yes, that's right, about what was going on. I think we would have been surprised that they weren't doing that. But the idea that they were doing more than that, that this was actually just the tip of the iceberg, well, as some wag related to me recently, you know, apparently quoting Gore Vidal, you know, we hadn't begun to touch the tip of the ice cube. You know, that's the thing. We've read a lot into what is a perfectly understandable and on one level quite justifiable, although very controversial move by US intelligence officials that at the time seemed to portend more.
Just finally, if you're looking at the ASIO of today and the ASIO of, say, around late 60s, early 70s, how do they compare in terms of their operations? Obviously, today's ASIO is much bigger and so on, but just in their proprieties, in their method of approaching the task.
Well, in the tail end of Volume 2, we talk about the commissioning of the Hope Royal Commission on Intelligence and Security. Hope's work is covered in Volume 3, which is coming out this time next year. And that is a story of a transformation. Hope lays down a mandate for reform of the intelligence community, not just ASIO, but the Australian intelligence community writ large. ASIO bears the brunt of his criticisms, and it goes through a cathartic and painful process of reform that's initiated in the tail end of this period, but then goes on throughout the periods in the years that follows, through to the end of the Cold War. And of course, in that is the whole question about, well, was ASIO penetrated? And that's something we grapple with in Volume 3.
We look forward to Volume 3. John Blaxland, thank you for talking with the conversation today. That's all for the podcast. Thanks to my producer, Pat Hutchins, and we'll be back with another interview soon.